With us.
Mr. Ted Sorensen. Mr. Sorensen was born in Lincoln, Nebraska. He attended the University of Nebraska and graduated there Phi Beta Kappa in 1949. In 1951, he received his law degree. In 1953, Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois recommended him for a job as administrative assistant to the then Senator Kennedy. When Senator Kennedy was elected president, his first appointment was to name Mr. Sorensen as his special counsel. Mr. Sorensen is the author now of the book Kennedy and also of Decision Making in the White House. It is with great pride and pleasure that I introduce to you Mr. Sorensen.
Thank you all. I hope you give the same kind of welcome to the Nebraska football team in the Orange Bowl this year. Madam Chairman, at least I think that's the right term. Cardinal Cushing said the other day that he has difficulty in addressing a woman presiding officer. He said the term madam used to be a term of respect used to address a queen, but some deterioration has set in. So he just says, my dear lady, and that's what I will say tonight. I want to express my thanks to all of you for coming, to the Student Forum Committee for inviting me, and to Governor Hayden Burns for making it possible. As a matter of fact, I had a dream last night that I had met my end and gone up to heaven and was denied admission at the gate on the grounds that I had, in my capacity as a speechwriter and political aide, made or written too many broken promises. I pleaded for admission. Finally, the angel at the gate, St. Peter, said, "Now, take this chalk and go up that ladder stretching up into the skies, and for every false promise you ever made, put a chalk mark on that ladder. They'll all flash in front of you." So I agreed to do it, and I took the chalk, and I started up the ladder. And it was pretty grim going, recalling all of those pledges. But as I was climbing and climbing and climbing, I felt someone stepping on my hand. I looked up and there was a man coming down, and I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm the governor of Florida." And I said, "Well, where are you going?" And he said, "Back for more chalk." I appreciated the plug which Ms. Conner gave to my new book, Kennedy. And if anyone here has a copy they'd like to have autographed, I'd be delighted to do it. That may be an unnecessary announcement. At the last college where I spoke, the head of the bookstore came up to me and she said, "Mr. Sorensen, I'm delighted to meet one of our authors." I thanked her. She said, "I wish I had 50 of your books in my store to sell." I said, "That's very, very nice of you. How many do you have?" And she said, 200. Of course, everyone hasn't liked the book. A member of the John Birch Society came up to me out in the Middle West. I know you don't have those around here. And he said, I read your book, and I thought it was terrible. Does that surprise you? I said, yes, frankly, it does. I didn't think any member of your organization could read. I might say that if you read my book closely enough, you will find a reference to my previous visit to this campus. I came here with the then Senator Kennedy when he addressed the Blue Key dinner, and it was notable and in the book only because it was the only occasion in all of the years we traveled together when we were unable to have separate rooms. We stayed at President Wright's house. I didn't realize then the budget problems he had that made it necessary. And I point out in the book that the president, then senator, had always insisted upon this in order that he could so that he could have a good night's sleep. But after my night here at the University of Florida, I always insisted on it so I could have a good night's sleep. I've given some thought to what I might say to this audience tonight. I asked. Not having a prepared text, I asked Arthur Schlesinger if he'd draft one for me, but he's working on something else. I don't know what it is. But I thought I might talk to you briefly and then answer your questions about the Kennedy legacy. Second was Kennedy's effect on the office of the presidency itself. Indeed, if I were to single out a single area in which Kennedy's tenure differentiated the most from that of his predecessor, I would select not some issue of domestic or foreign policy, but their conduct and concept of the presidency. Throughout American history, the office has been interpreted by the man according to his own philosophy and personality, rather than according to his party. To go back over 100 years, for example, James Buchanan was a Democrat. But Buchanan took so limited a view of the presidential powers, and as a result proved to be so inept and indecisive as the country slid toward dissolution and civil conflict, that Ohio's Senator Sherman, in a remark rather pertinent these days when we are talking about presidential disability, vice presidential succession, said as Buchanan fumbled in the White House, "The Constitution already provides for every accidental contingency in the chief executive, except for a vacancy in the mind of the president." But Buchanan, the Democrat, was succeeded by Lincoln, the Republican. And Lincoln was determined to make use of all the powers of the office, all that were specified and some that were not. So that when time came to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, he called together his wartime cabinet, which had been carefully chosen to reflect all the powerful interest groups making up the coalition. But he said to them, "I have called you here to read what I have written down. The main matter I have decided for myself." Kennedy was determined to be president in the Lincoln rather than in the Buchanan fashion. He made this clear in his campaign. As he said over and over again, "I run for the office of the presidency because it is the vital center of action in our society." And when time came for him to take the oath of office, he said, as you will recall in his inaugural address, that this was the hour of maximum danger for defending freedom in the world. And then he added, with emphasis, almost with glee, "I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it." He was determined that the president would dominate the White House, as not all presidents have, that the White House would dominate the executive branch, regardless of resentment from the bureaucracy, that the executive branch would lead the federal government, that the federal government would not have its will altered by individual states, and that the United States as a whole would fulfill its obligations of world leadership. This was in part a reflection of his personality. He had too much natural energy and vitality to accept the role of the president as a referee between contending factions in his bureaucracy. He had too much interest and curiosity to accept the concept of the president as a man to whom decisions were referred for final ratification or approval after being worked out at lower levels. He had too much zeal to accept the view that the presidency is above politics and that he should not involve himself in state and local elections. He had too much concern to accept the view that the legislative branch, as an equal and coordinate branch of government, should be left alone by the president as it acted on his program. He was determined to rule in Washington as well as to reign. And he did this not by over-institutionalizing the office, not by elaborate committees and machinery and secretariats and the cabinet and National Security Council and White House. He did it by personalizing the presidency, by using his White House aides as an extra set of eyes and ears and arms and legs to spread his will through Washington. He did it by his appearances on television and his press conferences and his travels around the country, alerting the American people to their problems and their opportunities as a nation, and talking not only about foreign and domestic crises, but about matters which were not contained in any statutory or constitutional document, about staying in school instead of dropping out, about physical fitness and 50-mile hikes, about the appreciation of art and culture, about not discriminating in our personal lives and neighborhoods, about the pursuit of excellence in every aspect of daily lives. As a result, he made the presidency a force in the everyday life of everyday Americans, and so influenced that office, in my view, that all who come after him will enjoy a greater power and prestige in the office and follow in a similar path. The third part of the Kennedy legacy was his effect on the American economy. Economics is supposedly a dismal science, and economic policies in Washington are considered dull by most of us. But in this dull and dismal material, Kennedy quietly worked a revolution in our thinking and planning. He taught us that fiscal policy, that is, our budget and taxes, constitute not merely a set of accounts to be balanced by accountants, but a living and movable tool to be used by the federal government to help shape and stimulate the American economy. He taught us that budget deficits are not always bad when they can provide new jobs and opportunities. Taxes have been cut in this country in the past only when one of three conditions happened to be present: a threatened recession or depression, or a budget surplus, or an equal reduction in expenditures. But Kennedy in 1963 submitted to the Congress the largest tax cut in history without any one of those three conditions being present, and the anticipation and benefits from that action gave this country the longest and strongest period of economic expansion in its peacetime history. The recession, which was due in 1962 or 1963, was skipped and has not yet occurred because Kennedy refused to accept the pessimistic view that every few years the American economy had to turn down, men had to be laid off, machines had to be idle. At the same time, he refused to accept an even more prevalent view that inflation was inevitable, that a growing economy had to be accompanied by rising prices. Some people said it was all right for a president to be against inflation in general and in theory, but he shouldn't do anything about price or wage increases in particular. But Kennedy did. He acted to prevent excessive wage labor cost increases on the railroads and the airlines and the aircraft industry and elsewhere. And he acted against big steel more successfully than any other president. And he had promulgated the wage price guidelines of his economic advisors. And all of this, once again, made it easier for any president who came after him to assert the public interest in these basically private decisions. Fourth was Kennedy's effect on what I would call the American ideal, the ideal of equality and opportunity and human dignity, which has been asserted since the beginnings of this republic, but very rarely fulfilled. Kennedy recognized, whatever the political cost, whatever the desires of everyone in the country, that a revolution in civil rights was taking place in this country. He placed himself at the head of that revolution in order to guide its force into constructive channels. He transformed civil rights from a political issue to a moral issue. He declared, as no one had previously declared in his position, that all forms of segregation and discrimination should not only be legally wrong, but morally wrong. But his concern for the American ideal was not limited to matters of race or religion. One of his favorite phrases in talking about civil rights was a fair chance. I know all Americans are not actually equal, he would say. They have differing capacities and talents, but they all ought to have a fair chance to develop those talents to the utmost of their capacity. And this was the key to his entire legislative program. Not merely members of minority groups, but all of those at the bottom of the economic and social ladder, the underprivileged and the unemployed and the underpaid, the retarded and the handicapped, those in need of better housing or better health or better education, the very young, the very old. It has become a cliche of our time to say that the Kennedy legislative program was not a success. But the fact is, as Theodore White has pointed out in his book this year, that we had the most fruitful 3 years of legislative action since the early 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt. We had this despite the fact that Kennedy took office with 21 fewer Democrats than had participated in the previous Congress, which had turned down or held up almost every item in his legislative program. So that in January of 1961, predictions were made that practically none of his program would pass, and yet practically all of it passed. More than 3 out of 4 roll call votes in the House and Senate floor. More than 100 important measures in the 87th Congress. And the 88th Congress was well on its way by November of 1963. It is true that there were delays. There were a few setbacks. But it was a controversial program. A man who is going to move and get his country moving is not going to meet with universal approval in a narrowly divided Congress. And yet the program was moving. And when it was passed in 1964, as much of it was passed after his death, the president, Mr. Johnson, and the leaders of both the House and the Senate, on both the Republican and the Democratic sides, said this was Kennedy's program, that he had introduced it, fought for it, built up public support for it, taken it over its most difficult legislative hurdles, and deserved the real credit for it. Kennedy himself, in his last press conference, had said, when this Congress goes home next year, he said, in effect, it'll have produced a record baby, but it's going to be an 18-month delivery. Finally, Kennedy's greatest legacy was his effect on American foreign policy. With respect to the new and developing nations, he laid the groundwork for placing our foreign aid on a more long-term and realistic basis, moving in emphasis more from military assistance to economic assistance, laying the groundwork for multilateral as well as unilateral aid, limiting our efforts to those countries willing to help themselves with their own local reforms and self-help. In Latin America, he initiated an alliance for progress, an alliance which he frankly acknowledged would take 10 years or more before it showed much progress, but which represented nevertheless more effort and concern than this country had shown toward its neighbors in the South for a generation or more. And to these countries, not only in Latin America, but in Africa and Asia and the Middle East, he sent the members of that unique organization which combined American idealism and energy and talent, the Peace Corps. With respect to the Western Alliance, Kennedy recognized that he was presiding over a period of transition in which the nations of Western Europe were emerging from dependence to a status of political and diplomatic and economic equality. And he welcomed that transition. And in the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, with its unprecedented tariff-cutting powers, he ended economic isolationism in this country for all time, and he laid the groundwork for his dream of an Atlantic partnership in the future. Finally, with respect to the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, his contribution was perhaps the most dramatic. The dramatics reached a height with the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy's carefully measured combination of just the right amount of defense and diplomacy and dialogue persuaded the Soviets that nuclear war would be suicidal, that nuclear blackmail was futile, and that effective, enforceable alternatives would be in the interests of both sides. That, in time, cleared the air. And in time, it led to the president's speech at American University, in which, for the first time, an American president looked beyond the Cold War and argued the common interest of the great powers in devoting the resources to peace. And in time, it led to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the first solid step toward disarmament in the nuclear age. It led to the hotline between Moscow and Washington to provide a communications link in case of emergency. It led to the ban on mass weapons from outer space, to the beginnings of cooperation between the American and Soviet space programs, to the first sale of American wheat to the Soviet Union, a sale which enabled our farmers and businessmen to share in the benefits, as other Western countries were doing, of the Soviet grain deficit, a sale which demonstrated, as nothing else could, the superiority of our agriculture over the collectivist farms, a sale which required the Soviets to spend their gold and their international exchange for food instead of for equipment and machinery with which arms are made. And a sale, finally, which demonstrated to the Soviet leaders once again that an atmosphere of harmony could serve the interests of both sides. In that atmosphere, the pressures on West Berlin were practically withdrawn. The hopes for a united Europe, not merely united Western Europe, but a united Europe, East and West, without an iron curtain, without a wall, began to appear as an ultimate possibility. And the prospects for a nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States, for the first time, vanished almost entirely. To be sure, in all of this, there was a large element of hope. But hope is the essence of the entire Kennedy legacy. Hope that politics can rise above the mediocre. Hope for an economy free from the cyclical effects of recession and inflation. Hope for an American presidency that is the embodiment of our ideals. Hope for the American tradition of equality and opportunity. Hope for a world free from the terrors of war and the tyrannies of dictatorship. And that is our obligation to the Kennedy legacy, to keep that hope alive, to elect men who believe in keeping that hope alive, to nourish those hopes, to spread them, so that generations from now, history and posterity will look back at our time and say, these were the years when the tide was turned. Now, I'd like to close by claiming a privilege sometimes afforded poets and playwrights of reading from my own work, some excerpts from the epilogue of my book. An era had suddenly ended. The world had suddenly changed, and the brightest light of our time had suddenly been snuffed out by mindless, senseless evil. There is a time to be born and a time to die, according to the passage he liked to quote from Ecclesiastes. But this was not John Kennedy's time to die. He had so much more to do and to give that no religion or philosophy can rationalize his premature death as though it served some purpose, and no biographer can assess his truncated life as though it had been completed. Upon his inauguration, he had vowed only to begin, but he had only begun. He was given so little time. If one extraordinary quality stood out among the many, it was the quality of continuing growth. By November 1963, he had learned more about the uses and limitations of power, about the men on whom he could depend, about the adversaries and evils he faced, and about the tools and techniques of policy. He had, in the words of his favorite Frost Bohm, promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. Almost everything seemed to be moving in his direction. Abroad after the Cuban Missile Crisis and Test Ban Treaty, at home with the tax and civil rights bills, in office with a more complete mastery of the executive branch, he was healthier and happier than he had ever been, neither wearied nor disillusioned by his burdens, more respected and beloved than before, still growing, still striving, confidently looking forward to 5 more years of progress in the presidency, and then suddenly to get cut off. The world's loss is the loss of what might have been. How then will history judge him? It is too early to say. I am too close to say. But history will surely record that his achievements exceeded his years. In an eloquent letter to President Kennedy on nuclear testing, Prime Minister Macmillan once wrote, "It is not the things one did in one's life that one regrets, but rather the opportunities missed." It can be said of John Kennedy that he missed very few opportunities. People will remember not only what he did, but what he stood for. For excellence in an era of indifference, for hope in an era of doubt, for placing public service ahead of private interests, for reconciliation between East and West, black and white, labor and management. It will not be easy for historians to compare John Kennedy with his predecessors and successors, for he was unique in his imprint upon the office. The first to be elected at so young an age, the first from the Catholic faith, the first to take office in an age of mutual nuclear capabilities, the first to reach literally for the moon and beyond, the first to prevent a new recession or inflation in modern peacetime, the first to pronounce that all racial segregation and discrimination must be abolished as a matter of right, the first to meet our adversaries in a potentially nuclear confrontation, the first to take a solid step toward nuclear arms control, and the first to die at so young an age. Just as no chart on the history of weapons could accurately reflect the advent of the atom, so it is my belief that no scale of good and bad presidents can rate John Fitzgerald Kennedy. One of the doctors at the Parkland Hospital in Dallas, observing John Kennedy's 6-foot frame on the operating table, was later heard to remark, "I had never seen the president before. He was a big man, bigger than I thought." He was a big man, much bigger than anyone thought, and all of us are better for having lived in the days of Kennedy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sorensen. Now, we have time now for some questions from the floor. Yes, sir.
What one piece of legislation, above all, did President Kennedy want enacted?
Should I repeat the questions?
I'll repeat each question. The question was, what one piece of legislation above all did President Kennedy want enacted? I'd be hard put to single out one. The Senate approval of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was probably the legislative action which meant the most to him, because it was the basis of his hopes for a new era in American foreign policy. He regarded the tax cut, which he submitted in 63, as essential for passage in order to keep the economy moving, and the Civil Rights Bill, which he submitted in 1963, as essential to prevent that situation from getting out of hand. There are many important bills, which some of which I mentioned in my prepared address, including the Trade Expansion Act in 1962, the health and education and welfare bills of various kinds which he submitted. So that, as I say, I'd be hard put to single out one.
There's a lot of controversy over which of the Kennedy brothers will be the one with the political future. I'd like to ask in your own personal opinion, who you think would be the one to watch.
The question was, which of the Kennedy brothers, in my own personal opinion, is the one to watch for national aspirations in the future? I don't know why it has to be limited to only one of them. They are different, and yet they have much in common. They both are articulate, forceful leaders of their party. They both have national followings. Both of them are young enough, and this is probably the key point, to have many, many national elections ahead of them. So it would be a foolish man who predicted that neither Kennedy brother would ever be on a national ticket. But they both also know better than any of us, after what happened, that in politics one doesn't count on the future. You just take one year at a time, one election at a time, one job at a time. They're both good United States senators now. They're both content to be just that.
Could you speculate, therefore, on what our policy would now be toward Vietnam?
The question is whether I would speculate on what our policy would now be toward Vietnam, were Mr. Kennedy still in the White House. Inasmuch as I do not have the same access to confidential information that I once had, my answer to that question, for the most part, would be idle speculation, and the kind of speculation that might keep me idle. Basically, I would say that President Kennedy was determined not to abandon this nation's long-standing commitment to the independence of South Vietnam. He was equally determined not to precipitate a general land war in Southeast Asia. Between those two extremes, he tried to manage an almost unmanageable problem. I believe President Johnson is also operating between those same two extremes. Whether the day-to-day tactics he has followed, much of which is dependent upon the advice of men whom Mr. Kennedy brought into government, would have been the same had Mr. Kennedy lived, it is truly impossible to say. But the basic objectives, I'm sure, are the same.
You have mentioned that Kennedy's strength and enlarged the powers of the government, the presidency in particular, and the Constitution. What limits did Kennedy believe should be placed on the government beyond which it should not or could not go?
The question is what limits Mr. Kennedy believed should be placed on the government in view of his enlargement of the powers of the presidency. The limitations were there, and they became more apparent to him as he served in the chief executive spot than were apparent to him when he had served in the Congress. And he explained it this way, that as an individual congressman and senator, he had felt that his contribution was rather limited. That was one of the reasons why he wanted to be president, because he felt he could do so much more about the problems he was concerned with anyway, as a citizen, as a father. But when he became president, then the Congress appeared to him to be more of a monolithic body with strong restrictive powers on not only appropriations, but particularly in domestic affairs on his authority. He at times chafed under those restrictions, and yet he knew that the Constitution was a wise document in separating and balancing powers between the executive and the legislative. The limitations set by the judicial branch were, of course, always present, although they raised no particular problem during his term. The federal system, which reserves a role for state and local government, is also a limitation. But the basic limitation is still that of public opinion. I said that the president did not intend to adhere to every whim and dictate of public opinion, and that is right. But neither could he, as President of the United States, get too far ahead of public opinion, because he was dependent upon the public for action in the Congress, for re-election, for general approval of what he was doing. Therefore, how to communicate with that public, how to educate the public, how to bring them along, was always a question before the White House. I think there's an interesting illustration here. The president felt that he could talk to the American people, but he couldn't make them listen. If they listened, he couldn't make them agree. If they agreed, he couldn't make them act. That was his problem. It was also a problem with the Congress. It was even a problem sometimes with the bureaucracy. So in November 1963, not long before he went to Dallas, he wrote a letter to Professor Rossiter, whose work on the American presidency he admired. And Rossiter had dedicated his new book on the presidency with a quotation from Macbeth, "Methought I heard a voice cry, sleep no more." Now that's a pretty apt quotation for a book about the most powerful office in the free world on which our very survival depends. But Kennedy had no trouble sleeping with his burdens. His problem, he thought, was to awaken other people to them. So he wrote to Rossiter that a more appropriate quotation from Shakespeare would be from King Henry IV, in which Glendower boasts, why, I can call spirits from the vasty deep. And Hotspur replied, aye, so can I, and so can any man, but will they come when you do call them? That's the limitation, basically, upon the present. The question is, now that I've finished my book, what do I plan to do? And I'm glad you asked that question because I'm available. I don't know what I'm going to do. I want to choose very carefully. It's somewhat of a crossroads in my life. In many ways, it's like beginning life all over again. I think the country and the world, in some ways, had to begin life all over again after November 1963, so that I'm not alone in that, but I'm not yet decided what I would do. And the other part of the question is whether I'm still working with the Kennedys. I'm good friends of all of them. I'm available for any tasks they may give me, which from time to time they do, but I have no formal association with them. The questioner began by saying he knew I wrote most of Mr. Kennedy's speeches, and he wondered how far the president left them alone. The initial statement is not correct in any real sense of the word. I worked with Mr. Kennedy on all of his major speeches. The more years I worked with him, the easier it became for me to write a first draft which contained his thoughts. My job in the White House required me to take part in the meetings which produced the decisions which were reflected in the speeches, so that I knew the evidence and arguments which influenced him. I had heard what he had to say on these particular problems. I could gather from earlier speeches and statements and private memos, documents, the relevant arguments and facts. But that first draft, when it was submitted to Mr. Kennedy, was gone over word for word. He would add or delete or change whole pages or paragraphs or phrases or individual words. Sometimes he would reject the whole draft and ask me to start over again. Sometimes after the draft was absolutely finished and put out as the final text, he would, particularly if you were on the road, use it simply as a springboard and take off and for extemporaneous remarks on his own. Sometimes he would discard it entirely, again, when he was on the road, this usually was, so that the Washington Press Corps sometimes referred to him as a text deviant. But when he spoke on television, when he spoke to the Congress or the United Nations and the American people, then he would follow his final text very closely. But that final text represented in every word and paragraph his own thoughts and his own policy. I didn't get the question. The question is why I don't ask Hayden Burns for a job, and I think Florida's had sufficient experience with carpetbaggers. The question is, what were the president's personal thoughts about the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. I might first say that the answer to that question and practically all of these questions is in my book, and I wouldn't want to discourage sales by giving everything out here. His personal thought was that this was the greatest crisis that the country had been in modern times. We did not know what the Soviet intentions were. If we reacted too strongly, we would not have, he felt, the support of our allies. And the Russians might be able to divert our attention on Cuba while they moved in on Berlin. On the other hand, if we reacted too weakly, then no ally would ever have confidence again in our ability to stand up to the Russians. And the Latin Americans would recognize the handwriting on the wall and quickly succumb to Castroism. So he felt that it was a difficult and delicate period. He assumed that whichever course he chose, and each of the possible courses was carefully reviewed, that whichever course he chose, the country was in for a prolonged period of hovering between, hovering on the brink of nuclear war. Perhaps his personal thoughts, as you worded, are best illustrated by the fact that on Saturday, that is the Saturday after the missiles were discovered, when the time came for him to make his final decision, he called his wife, who was in their country home in Virginia, in Glenora, and asked her to come to the White House. Not because he was going to consult with her, that was not his way as president, that was not her way as his wife. But because he knew it was the most important decision he would ever make as president, and he wanted her to be there at the time. And in a sense, his personal thoughts were also illustrated by the fact that a few days later, he asked her whether she wanted to take the children and go to the underground bomb shelter, which had been provided, or at least to live near it, which had been provided some ways away from Washington for the first family. And she said to know that if anything happened, she wanted to come over to his office and share it with him. At the end of that week, that is, after he made his announcement on Monday, and there seemed to be some hope that the ships were turning back in the middle of the week, on the end of that week, Saturday, once again, the president felt, and we all felt, that we were closer to nuclear war than the world had ever been. The Khrushchev note of the previous day, which contained the germ of the solution which was finally worked out, had been supplanted by a new public Khrushchev letter which raised the ante. Our low-level reconnaissance planes had been fired on. Our high-level U-2 plane over Cuba had been shot down by a Russian missile, that is, an anti-aircraft missile, which were manned only by Russians. The photographs showed that work was going full speed ahead on the missile sites, that Khrushchev wasn't waiting to see what our answer was to his letters, but was putting in permanent installations to house the nuclear warheads and the troops. Then came another report about the Soviet ship, one of those with the long hatches, going full speed ahead toward the quarantine barrier, accompanied by a submarine. So we began to think that maybe Khrushchev was determined to rub our nose in the dirt and that he was going to force Kennedy to back down. Kennedy did not back down. He made clear in his answer to the original Khrushchev letter, which more or less ignored the second one, that we would not back down. And that message, when that letter was conveyed that night through the Soviet ambassador, it was accompanied by a verbal message that we would not back down, that it was up to Khrushchev to choose between peace or war. And the next morning, he chose peace.
How much longer would Kennedy have waited on that decision whether to go into Cuba or not? Was it a matter of days, or one day, or a matter of hours?
The question is how much longer he would have waited as to whether to actually invade Cuba at that time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It certainly was not a matter of hours. It might have been a matter of days. That is hard to say, because Bob McNamara told me that he woke up the next morning, early Sunday morning, before the broadcast came from Moscow, and said that he determined to draw up a list of steps which we could take short of invasion. Now, those steps would have included tightening the blockade. They would have included increasing the low-level flights over Cuba, which were an effective form of harassment. Yeah. They might have included a variety of other actions or appeals. But the fact remained that an American plane had been shot down, a Soviet ship was coming up to challenge the quarantine, work was going ahead on the missile sites, so that there could not have been very much delay.
In your book, you mentioned that Kennedy would rather have run against Goldwater than anyone else. Would you give a few reasons why? Besides the obvious.